The White Sox lost to Detroit 10-2. Tonight, the Brewers and White Sox are off. The Cubs play the Nats in Washington. And the NFL season's underway tonight, Thursday Night Football, Atlanta at Philadelphia. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, 6th of September. Cloudy and cool, isolated showers possible this morning, a high of 68. Overnight, 55. Friday looks great, partly sunny and 73. This morning, 61 in Racine, 64 in Kenosha, humidity at 85%, little breeze from the north-northeast at 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have really enjoyed reading a brand new book called Eat Cake, Be Brave. And this book is something of a memoir written by someone named Melissa Radke. And it's very likely that you have perhaps come across some of her wonderful videos that reach out to the public across a number of different platforms as well. And her memoir is also a really intriguing look at some of what she has contended with in her life, and particularly during her childhood, and the way in which she was able to kind of turn things around, come to terms with some of the demons that had plagued her, and has really found a wonderfully happy and fulfilling life in so many different respects. And the book is published by Grand Central Publishing, and I'm very, very excited to speak with Melissa Radke about her story and about this book, again called Eat Cake, Be Brave. Melissa Radke,
thank you.
We welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, but be honest. Did you first think it was just a book about cake, and that's why you got really excited about it?
Well, I am a fan of cake, but as I read it, I continued to be intrigued and enjoyed this book a whole lot, even though I'm not sure I'm part of the sort of demographic to which it is aimed, but I found it really compelling on all kinds of different levels, and really, really funny, but also really moving. I guess that's one of the things that I like best about the book, is that it is a really nice mix of funny and serious. Is that how it just kind of naturally came to be, or did you need to kind of consciously think about balancing those two elements together?
Well, first of all, let me just say that unless you've got the deepest voice I've ever heard, you are in fact a man. I mean, I'm not seeing you face to face, but you are in fact a man, which makes officially like four men that have read this book. So that is very impressive. I'm super happy about that. You know what? That's the thing. Okay, so sometimes when I tell my story, or if I'm doing an interview or whatever, it probably comes across like the story is really sad. It's I would say 80% of my book is laughter, is very funny. And I don't think it was hard for me to balance that, because I am by nature a funny person, a jovial person. I like to laugh a lot. So writing like that wasn't difficult for me. In fact, if anything, I would turn it into my editor and she'd go, okay, you can't make this like all laughter. There are some serious moments in here. Let them breathe. It's okay for people to have a punch in the gut every once in a while, Melissa. So, you know, it's not a yuck fest by any imagination, but there are some serious moments, and I think we balanced them pretty well.
I absolutely agree. I said something about your personal demons, and I want to make sure people don't get the wrong idea about what we are talking about, because sometimes you hear those words and you go to a really, really dark place. What we're talking about in your case, is as much as anything, is that growing up, you were a very overweight young girl who also just felt like she did not easily fit in really anywhere. And this was obviously a source of tremendous pain for you. And
it was, yeah.
And
who's the person, who can raise their hand and say, seventh grade was easy for me? Like, it was just a breeze. Like, I don't think that person exists. It's such a difficult coming of age time anyway, but then to have a body where you look like you're the student teacher, you know, you look like you're the sub that came in. I write in the book that when I was in the fifth grade, people were asking me to sign their hall passes because they truly were. Nobody knew who I was. I kind of blended into the crowd. I was the size of a teacher when I was like 11 years old. So it wasn't the funnest childhood. I'll give you that.
Right. In fact, it's interesting. There's a whole chapter in your book, or a portion of a chapter, where you, in a sense, raise a glass to various people in your life who were really kind of facilitators or instigators of some of the pain that you really felt, or ostracism, or just being kind of ignored, and once in a while even, you know, really kind of made fun of and bullied. What did it feel like to write those salutations to some of those people, in which you were trying to shed the lingering pain of what some of these peers had done to you? What was that all about?
Well, I'm glad you asked about it. For your listeners, that is a chapter in my book. I love chapter titles. All of my chapter titles are something kind of funny and ambiguous. That one is called, that chapter is called, People Who Might Want to Think Twice Before Asking Me for Money. And it really, I began writing it, honestly, I started writing it almost a bit therapeutic-wise, like probably wouldn't go in the book. But the more I wrote it, the more I shaped it, it felt good for me. I would give it to my editor to read, and she would say, I would say, do I just sound like sour grapes? I don't want to sound like sour. I don't want to have one whole chapter that's just me being sour grapes. And she said, Melissa, these are real things. I felt like they were. I remembered them. Chances are, if we asked your listeners, or if I asked you, you could pinpoint times when people's words have cut you so deep. We don't forget. We have to forgive, but we don't forget. And so I began to write this chapter, and it felt so good for me once it was done. And I said to my husband, and I said to my editor, look, if y'all don't think we should put it in, we won't. But they said, yes, let's put it in. And so many people have said, I could have made a list like that. Here's the great thing about the chapter. If there is one good side to that chapter, it's that it's not terribly long.
Right.
It's not 18 pages. It's really not. I mean, there are parts of my life that are beautiful and blessed, and I'm fortunate. It's not 18 pages worth of sour grapes, but there's some hurt there.
Sure.
And I have to tell you, I didn't change any names in that chapter. There are some true names in that chapter, and I don't feel bad for putting them because I was wounded, and it's taken 40 years to get over some of those.
Sure. So just to pick one of the people to whom you raise a glass is someone named Jason. You worked with him at a fried chicken place called Grandy's in Lufkin,
yep.
Texas. Tell our listeners what Jason did and what difference it made to kind of sign off on what he had done to you so many years ago.
Well, it's so funny because I thought you were going to say to me, pick one person to talk about with me right now. That's what I thought. So in my mind, I'm going over who I would talk about, and I would have talked about him.
Huh.
So it's so funny that you mentioned him. You know, Jason was 2 years older than me, and he worked. My very first job was at a fried chicken restaurant. And just a little sweet side note to that, I found out years later that my dad parked across the street in the parking lot across the street and watched me get off work every night for the first 2 weeks of my job, watched me walk out to my car and drive home because he was so concerned about me. He was a good dad. But I worked with this guy, Jason. He went to a different school as I did, but he was very popular, well-known, cute kid. And he heard me lamenting over the fact that my prom was coming up and I didn't have anybody, nobody had asked me. And he said, let me take you. And I said, are you serious? And he said, yes, let me take you. It will be fun. We have a great time at work. And I had never been to a prom. I had never been to any dance. I had never been to a homecoming. No one ever asked me to go. In fact, I was always the girl that would come into the homecoming games and sing the national anthem and then leave because I had a good voice, but I didn't have a good body. So that was kind of my, that was my life back then. And he asked me to go, and I got so excited. My mom and I went prom dress shopping. We found this dress. I had loved it. I had seen it in a magazine years before. I bought it. I was so excited. The day it came in, I told him, I said, okay, it came in. Do you want to know what color, like, bow tie to get, or how does that work? And he looked at me, and he started dying laughing, like almost with tears coming out of his eyes. He was laughing so hard. He said, you could not have possibly thought I was serious. And I, that is literally, like, whenever I tell that story, people go, but then what did you say? I didn't say anything. What do you say after that? Mm. They go, well, what did you tell him off? No, I'm 16. I didn't tell him off. You're wounded. Someone has just shot you. There's not a comeback for that. And I can remember walking out, hanging up my visor on the wall as I walked out because my shift was over, and him just laughing and going, y'all, seriously, surely y'all knew I wasn't serious, right? How did she think I was serious? And so he had brought everyone into this moment, and I've never forgotten it.
Wow. And I think, you know, as I think about that moment in your life, I think part of what's probably especially hard about it is that you certainly had some mean people in your life. I mean, and all they were was mean. This is a case of somebody who was, the way you describe him anyway, is largely a really nice person. And and this thing that he did, perhaps he didn't even mean it to be as terribly unkind as it turned out to be. But, I mean, what a terrible surprise when unkindness comes to us from somebody who's kind of a decent person.
Exactly.
So what did it feel like to kind of spell that out? I mean, and what was that experience like for him and for some of these others who really inflicted pain on you once upon a time? What did it do for you to kind of spell this all out and try to let go of it?
Well, first of all, you bring up a really good point by saying he sounds like he probably was a pretty nice guy who did a very unkind thing. And one of the things that I think it did by writing that chapter, letting that be a therapeutic kind of process for me, is that it opened my eyes to the fact that sometimes we can – look, here's the deal. I can't change anybody my age. I can only change people that I'm raising. Those are the only people that I can work on, okay? I can't work on you and fix you. I can't work on my neighbor and fix them, but I can work on my kids. And so what it taught me is that I need to raise people to their default is kindness. That's their default, okay? It's not enough to be a good person, but when we're back in a corner, unkindness comes out of us, hurt comes out of us. And I've been trying to teach my kids how worthy and how valuable they are. And then I say, so who is really worthy? And they'll say, we are. And I'll say, who else is? And they say, everybody else. Mm. I want to teach my kids their inherent value of themselves and of everyone around them. See, everybody's valuable. Everybody's worthy. So we can't let kindness must be our default. When we're back in a corner, we're kind. When we find ourselves embarrassed in front of a crowded restaurant of our peers that are coworkers, and we want to be funny, we're still kind. That must be our default. And I learned that. I look back at that list and I go, come on, guys. We could have all been better than this. Mm. We were all good people who made hurtful comments. Why? Mm. And so that's I'm not trying to change the people on that list. I'm trying to change the people in my house.
I like that. By the way, although, of course, now you are living in a world and living a life in which you are not the subject of that kind of unkindness, not the same kind of unkindness, but it still happens, particularly because so much of your time is spent creating wonderful and entertaining videos that appear online. And, of course, with online videos come comments. And some of those comments are sadly reminiscent, I'm sure, of some of what you experienced as a youngster. One of the things you write about those kind of unkind comments in your book is this: lies from, you characterize them as lies from small people with big voices. Don't let cowards with lung capacity ever again determine your value and your worth. But I think that's so interesting to think about some of those really unkind comments that we see as being lies from small people with big voices. I'm glad you share that lesson with us.
Did I write that? Man, Man, you I'm a good writer.
You are. And let me
let
me reintroduce you. My guest is Melissa Radke, and we're talking about her book called Eat Cake, Be Brave. In my other life, apart from the radio station, I am a assistant professor of music at our local college, and so I have to have you share with our listeners a really great story that you share in one of the chapters where you talk about life at college. And generally speaking, I think college was a happier time for you than elementary, middle school, high school, but you still had lots of trouble, I mean, of one kind or another. And there's a really great story that you tell about, skipping out on an important concert that ultimately imperiled your very graduation from Belmont University.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners about this bad choice that you made in your senior year.
Well, it felt a little bit when I was writing it like a bit of a random story to put in there. And I wondered if the readers, when they're reading it, they're like, why is she telling us this story? But it all has a point, and this is the story. My senior year of college, I am required to do, it's called oratorio. That's a fancy word for choir, okay? And so you know that. But essentially, that's kind of what it is. All of the music majors get together, and they form this big, huge choir, and they sing this big, fancy piece that's in Latin or German or whatever. And we're required to be there. We practice it all year, and then there's the final night. The audience is packed. The university board is there. The president of the School of Music there. Everybody. And right before I got there that night, my girlfriends called me that weren't in the music department, and they said, Melissa, there's a run on margaritas and fajitas right down the road. Why don't you meet us? Now, here's the deal with me. When push comes to shove, if shove is a little bit funner, if shove comes with queso and half-price margaritas, I'm a shove kind of girl. I'm going to always go where the fun is, okay? Even at times when I'm obligated to do other things that I don't want to do. And so I write about how this evening they filed us in, and we stood in our long black dresses, and the guys were in tuxes, and we stood on these risers for this 200-voice oratorio choir. And right as the conductor lifted up his whatever you call that, whatever he's going to conduct with, I knelt down on the backstage and crawled out of the auditorium where no one could see me. Now, I did this because this was several years ago, and we didn't have iPhones recording. I didn't know it was being recorded. You know, this was still during kind of like DVD and CD times, and so, but it was being recorded. I did not know this. I skipped out. I met my girlfriends for drinks and fajitas, had a wonderful night, came in a couple of days later, and the director of the oratorio called me into his office, and he proceeded to play the videotape for me, the videotape that I had no idea would exist. And he would say, look, there you are. Oh, now you're gone. He would rewind it. Oh, but look at it. There you are. Now you're gone. I wrote about that story, though funny, it still pains my mother to even hear it. I wrote about that story because that's what we do when we have a lot of hurt in our lives. We show up for big moments, but if they get hard, we take the easy way out. And I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't do that anymore. I had to face people that hurt me. I had to face depression. I had to face the things that I had put on myself. We can't sing victim all our lives. We can't keep skipping out because something else looks funner. We can't keep skipping out because there's half-price drinks and we can avoid the pain.
Right.
We have to stand still and sing the song. And so that's kind of what I wrote about.
I think that's so great. I want to read this portion as you're kind of finishing up the story. You write, sometimes, my friend, and believe me, I wouldn't say this if it weren't true, sometimes the hard work is the only work that can be done. You cannot keep jumping off risers and calling it a night. Sometimes you have to stay. You have to grow up, wear the dress, and stay for the whole song. You stay for the grade. You stay for the love. You stay for the commitment. You stay for the payoff. Is it fun? No. Is it necessary? Well, that depends. What do you want? I mean, you've really spelled out a great life lesson there, and I'm really glad you you share that story. And I'm glad that that despite your significant talent as a singer, nobody let you off the hook. I mean, you did not graduate in May. You did not graduate until the following December. So you had to bear the cost of a bad decision, and good for you.
And absolutely. And what stunk about it was that I was married in college, and so I wanted to graduate with my husband, Radke, sitting by Radke, getting to walk across the stage together. All of our parents would come down for it. It would be a joyous, momentous occasion, and he got to graduate, and I didn't. Hey, that's a life lesson. I have never forgotten that experience. I could have spit nails. I was so mad that they were holding me back a semester and not letting me graduate. I can't think of anything better now, not because it's good material for a book, though it is, but because I learned that we have to face the hard stuff in order to get past it, in order to succeed. And I'm a very self-aware person, but that hasn't come easily. It's taken a lot of counseling and a lot of journaling and a lot of coming to grips with who I am and my faith and my spirituality. And so that's come at a high cost, but I'm certainly glad I stuck around and paid it.
Me too. It's a great, great story. You also talk about your marriage and the circumstances under which you first met the man whom you ultimately married. You also share some really poignant stuff about struggles with infertility, and ultimately the joys of being parents. I want you to say a quick word about someone named Danielle, and what you tell us about the book in the book about Danielle.
First of all, Danielle is a change of a name, and I did that because I didn't want to expose her in any way. But my husband and I went through 12 years of infertility. Finally, we had a son and lost him on actually Christmas morning. He was born on Christmas morning of 2005 and lived for about an hour and a half, and then went to heaven. And 3 months after his death, I got a phone call. Word of mouth, a friend of a friend of a friend heard of a young birth mom that was wanting to find a family for her child. Her child was due in about 6 weeks. And I met with Danielle, but you can see now why I changed her name. I met with her and loved her instantly. And I wrote a chapter in this book because here's the deal. If this book is about anything, it's about how we can, believe it or not, do hard things. Danielle is a perfect picture of doing hard things. In Texas, legally, a birth mom has to wait 24 hours before they sign over adoptive rights. They have to wait 24 hours. They have to think about that decision. In some states, it's longer. Some states, it's 10 days. But in Texas, it's 48 hours. And this child, my daughter, was born in Texas. And so Miss Danielle had 48 hours to think about this decision. It was an agonizing 48 hours for me, as you can imagine. I wanted this baby so bad. I was already in love with this baby. And on the morning that I went to the hospital to pick her up, to pick up the baby, I walked into a room that we could not have fit another ounce of love in that room. The love that Miss Danielle showed for that baby in her arms, I can't even describe it to you. When it was time for her to hand that child over to me, she didn't do it with sobbing and wailing and the gnashing of teeth and rending her garments. She did it with a quiet and holy respect for that child. She kissed that child. She held on to her. And then she handed her over to me. And I'm telling you, I have never seen a more heroic moment. You know, not everybody agrees with adoption. But I'll tell you what. There have been multiple birth moms who have come up to me during book signings and said, I just read that and I replaced my name. I replaced my name with Danielle because I needed somebody to tell me that what I did was a good thing. What that woman did for us and for that child, it was such a brave moment. And I told her that day when I went to go walk out of that room, I said, you listen to me. You will always be talked about in our home with respect. you will always be talked about in a high and holy manner. I can promise you that you're a hero in our home forever. And that's why we put a Miss in front of her name. Like, we respect her. She is Miss Danielle, and we talk about her often. And I tell about her beautiful hair and her button nose, and I tell about her skin and how gorgeous she was. And I tell about how she made me laugh and how she was really great in sports, Remy. When she was growing up, she told me that. And I talk about those things, and we talk about her with great respect. We all have to do hard things. And Miss Danielle did it with such grace and elegance. And so I never want my daughter to forget that.
Love that story so much. Let's finish out by having our listeners talk about, hear about your 41st birthday, because that turned out to be an enormously important turning point for you. A lot of times we talk about 40. For you, it was turning 41, which was the real moment when you were able to finally put some of life's hurts behind you and really chart a new path for yourself. Why 41 and not 40?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I wish I could tell you. My 40th was fun. It was great. It was a lot of fun. My friends were there. There was loud music, and we had a great time. But I still wasn't living free. I still wasn't living free of what they said about me. I still wasn't living free of how they hurt me. I still wasn't living free. I wrote in the book, I spent more time dying inside the four walls of my home than I really did really living. So, yeah, I yucked it up. I had a great time when I turned 40, but I wasn't free. I wasn't a free person. I hadn't done the hard work. I hadn't done the heavy lifting on my life yet. But for some reason, at 41, I went to go blow out the candles on my cake, which is why it's called Eat Cake, Be Brave. I went to go blow out the candles on my cake, and it was my kids, my two children, both by adoption, who were started to fight over the wish. Make a wish. Tell us what you wish. No, she can't tell us what she wish. Yes, she can. She's a mom. She can tell us. And I listened to how much stock they were putting into this stupid wish, and I thought, oh, for Pete's sake, I'm just going to make a wish, which as adults, we don't really do that. And I leaned down and I made a wish. This is what I wished. I said, for 12 months, I'm going to be brave for 12 months. I'm going to live for 12 months. If it scares me, if my pulse races, if my pits sweat, I'm going to do it. That's how I know I'm going to be living. I'm going to try things that when I lived in Nashville and they said, hey, honey, you can sing, but people just don't buy ugly. I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to do what they said I couldn't do. And I blew out the candles. I don't know why. I hadn't recently read a book on bravery. I hadn't, you know, seen some inspirational cat poster that had, like, would you get to the end of your rope, tie a knot, and hang on. I don't know why. But I did it. It was a moment of destiny, I guess. And my life changed in the next 12 months. My life forever changed because I decided to live outside of the box than the one I had painted for myself.
Nicely put. Well, I really encourage our listeners to seek out your book. It is really a delight. And as I said, at different turns, hilariously funny and deeply, deeply moving. The book, again, is Eat Cake, Be Brave, published by Grand Central, the author Melissa Radke. Melissa Radke, I really enjoyed your book, and I really enjoyed this chance to speak with you. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed you just as much. Thank you, sir.
The time is 8:38. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Part two of today's program is coming up in just a moment. My guest for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show is Dr. Marie Pazinski, a Harvard neurologist and the author of a book called Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, Look Radiant from the Inside Out by Empowering Your Mind. Dr. Pazinski knows a lot about the human brain, about how it functions, about the way in which it impacts our well-being on so many different levels. And she makes some connections in this book that may come as something of a surprise, and the way in which the health of one's brain and the vitality of one's mental life can have a whole lot to do with the way you feel and the way you carry yourself and the way in which the world sees you. We're also going to spend a few minutes talking about all of the different facets of a neurologist's work, and in particular, the concern which many people have around one of the most significant of brain injuries, and that would be the stroke, and how strokes can be perhaps avoided or prevented, or the best way to respond when someone is unfortunate enough to be suffering a stroke. So all of that is ahead of us, and I want to repeat the name of the book again, Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You. Dr. Marie Pazinski, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
I wonder if we could begin by having you say a word about how you became a neurologist. I guess not so much how, but maybe why. If there was something that in particular about this particular field that was so attractive to you. I suspect that you were weighing a lot of different possibilities. How is this the one that you ultimately chose?
Well, I was fortunate in medical school to have a wonderful mentor who was an artist before he went into medicine. And actually, I studied art before I went into medicine. In fact, my first experience going into thinking about medicine was when my oldest brother asked me to come see his cadaver in medical school. And I'll never forget, he took me over to the anatomy lab that night, and he was showing me the dissection that they had done on the upper extremity. And for me, it was like Leonardo da Vinci's neuroanatomy drawings coming alive. And, you know, I saw the beauty of the human body. And as an artist, to see what was under the skin and how the body was put together, I was so struck by that. And that's how I first became interested in medicine. And then when I did my neurology rotation during medical school, my attending neurologist, the one who kind of oversaw my work, happened to be an artist as well. And so it was kind of that connection that I think drew me in. He was able to show me how beautiful the brain is and how it is endlessly fascinating.
What does a neurologist concern themselves with apart from the human brain? I mean, I suspect that although that certainly should be more than enough to occupy one academic and professional attention, I suspect, in fact, your area of focus when it comes to safeguarding people's well-being has to do with even more than the actual brain itself.
Right. It's overall health. The brain truly is the like CEO of our body. It controls everything about us. And our body is our support staff, more or less, because we need a healthy body to keep our brain running at its best. So the two really work together. And it's important to me as a neurologist to do everything that I can to help people keep their brain and their bodies healthy. And so I care for patients with a wide range of neurologic problems, which includes migraine, epilepsy, dementia, stroke, certainly, movement disorders. It's a very broad field.
And I should think a very exciting field, in the sense that so many of the technological breakthroughs have directly impacted this particular area of medical science in such exciting ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, the brain in many ways is the last frontier of the human body. You know, we still have so much to learn, but there have been incredible breakthroughs over recent years, and this is what's so exciting. I think the most important, most significant breakthrough is our understanding that our brain is constantly changing. You know, we used to think it was static and that we were born with all the brain cells we would ever have, but what we now understand is that our brain is constantly changing, and it has the ability to make new brain cells and new connections throughout our lives. And the other thing we realize is that every experience changes our brain. So even if you and I are talking and people are listening, our brains are changing. And what we now understand is that the more stimulating these experiences are, the more enriching, the more profound the changes in the brain can be.
At what point did you come across or conceive of this connection between the health of the brain and one's beauty? It's such an intriguing idea. At what point did this first occur to you, that this was a connection that people need to make?
Well, actually from personal experience. I'll never forget one morning I was really stressed out. It was a very busy time in my life. I'm a mother of two, and my youngest was actually quite young. I was doing my residency. I was sleep deprived. I was not taking care of myself. I was neglecting my brain. And I'll never forget looking in the mirror one morning and just feeling mentally foggy, just not feeling clear at all. And I had this look in my face, just kind of this vacant, dull look that kind of matched the way I felt mentally. You know, and it struck me then that no amount of, you know, makeup or, you know, beautiful hairstyle was going to change the way I look. That the problem was I wasn't having a bad brain day, or I wasn't having a bad hair day. What I was having was a bad brain day. And that's how I kind of came up with this idea. And, you know, and you realize that your brain determines everything about you. It truly is your essence. And it is the source of our inner beauty. Every thought, emotion, and mood comes from our brain. And it interprets every sensation that we have in every movement that we make. And many people don't realize it, but it also determines the way you present yourself to the world. You can never look your best unless your brain is functioning at its best.
Towards that end, you have quite a number of suggestions. I mean, they're kind of wrapped up in, I think, a big list of seven steps that one can take either successively or concurrently, but steps one can take to really enhance the health of one's brain. And it's kind of a combination of choices to embrace, I mean, things to do, and certain things to avoid as well, which you think significantly compromise the health of the brain. Let's actually start with the latter. What are some things that people should avoid when it comes to wanting to enhance the health of their brain?
Well, one of the most important things we can do is stay physically active. So physical inactivity can really negatively affect your brain. There's been exciting research showing that when we're physically active, we get our heart rate up. We actually have increased the blood flow to our brain, and this increased blood flow promotes the birth of new neurons and the formation of new connections. And there are exciting studies showing that people who do regular exercise, they actually did a study where they looked at the volume of people's brains by MRI. We have the ability to do that now, before beginning an exercise regimen and then afterward. And they had a control group that didn't exercise aerobically. Instead, they did a stretch and tone class. And those that exercised aerobically and got their heart rate up showed an increased volume in their brain. They actually increased the thickness of their cortex. And that's the part of the brain that we reason with and make memories with. And so this is so exciting and shows how important exercise is and how you can really make your brain healthier, stronger, and more vibrant by exercise.
I know that you feel strongly about certain dietary choices that can make a real difference. Can you highlight two or three of those that you believe would make a very significant difference for the better?
Mm-hmm. So in Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, I recommend what's called the SMART diet. And one of the key things about the diet is choosing the type of fats that you eat and making smart choices around the type of fats. Our brain is actually two-thirds fat, and the main fat in our brain is omega-3s. And our body cannot make omega-3s, so the only omega-3s we can get are through our diet. So it's really important to eat a diet rich in omega-3s and to avoid saturated fats, unhealthy fats, because those actually clog up the arteries that supply the brain. Our brain only weighs 3 pounds, but it actually uses 20% of the blood flow that our heart puts out. And so maintaining good blood flow to the brain is extremely important. And so that's why it's being aware of the type of fats that you're eating and avoiding those that clog up our arteries and reduce blood flow to the brain is extremely important.
I know that you have suggestions, some of which are perfectly reasonable and are more like reminders for us of things that we probably are already quite aware of are good stimulating things for us to do. But you certainly have suggestions in your book, Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, which probably fall well outside the realm of the obvious in terms of different kinds of activities that can be beneficial. Give a couple of examples to our listeners.
Well, one of the things I recommend is people try new things and open their brain to new ideas. As I was saying, every experience we have changes our brain. And as we get older, we so often limit ourselves to being open to new experiences. We get in a rut. And what happens is when we're doing the same kind of things, we're stuck in our routine, we're actually using the same mental pathways. But when we learn something new, we're actually forging new mental pathways. So I really encourage people to really think about that. What are they doing for their brain that's new and exciting and is going to challenge their brain? One of the things I also talk about is thinking about what I call your life learning curve. And that means the number of new things or new activities you take up, new things you're exposed to during your everyday life. And if you were to map that out, I think most of us would have so many new experiences and new ideas when we were young and in school. You know, we're constantly meeting new people, going new places, being exposed to new ideas. And all of that is so wonderful for our brain. But as we get older, we tend to get into a routine way of living, a routine way of thinking. We solve the same kind of problems. And in that way, we're not using our brain to its full potential. So I recommend that people, you know, try to take up a new activity, you know, whatever strikes your fancy. It's best if it's something that you're passionate about. And the idea is that when you learn a new activity, you really are making new pathways in your brain. That's exciting. Your brain actually spurts out dopamine when it's exposed to something new, and that increases your attention and it makes it pleasurable too.
This is maybe an important moment for us to say that someone might see the title Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, and think that this book has nothing to offer to men. And that would be a mistake.
You're right. The principles are the same. They would apply to men and women. There are 7 steps in the book that they kind of build on each other and support each other, and in the process, you'll end up with a healthier, more vibrant brain.
We are speaking with Dr. Marie Pazinski. We've been talking about her book, Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, published by Hyperion. For our last couple of minutes, I wonder if we could talk just a bit about stroke. For a couple of different reasons, stroke information, stroke prevention has been in the news quite a lot, maybe most dramatically because of that on-air experience of a young female reporter who was suddenly speaking gibberish, unable to form proper coherent words. although she ended up not being the victim of a stroke, but rather a severe migraine headache, evidently, the fact that this event occurred in the public eye has certainly sparked kind of a renewed interest and concern about strokes and other kinds of brain injuries. First of all, what is most important for the common, ordinary citizen to know about strokes in terms of their own well-being? And are there things that one can do to lessen the likelihood of that a stroke is going to be a part of their own future?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I'd like to emphasize is knowing the symptoms of stroke. You can save a life, or help yourself. What most people don't realize is that even if the symptoms of stroke go away, that means the brain is in trouble. So it's not uncommon before a stroke for people to have what's called a TIA or a stroke warning. So these are neurologic symptoms like weakness or difficulty speaking that last maybe 5 minutes and then go away. And too often people feel, well, if the symptoms go away, I'm fine, that they don't do anything about it. But that actually is an emergency. We should call 911 if any of these symptoms develop again, even if they go away. So the five symptoms of stroke can be remembered as walk, talk, reach, see, and feel. So if someone suddenly has trouble walking, their balance is off, or they're dragging a leg, if there's a change in their talking, their speech becomes slurred, or they are not making sense. Reach refers to having difficulty raising one arm, being weak on one side. If there's a sudden change in vision, if someone loses part or all of their vision, or a sudden severe headache, all of those are potential signs of a stroke. And again, when these symptoms develop, it's so important to get medical attention. And again, even if they go away, because it means that the brain is in trouble. And certainly if they don't go away and they persist, medical evaluation is needed. We now have, some therapies that we can give to people who have stroke, but many times people do not get to the hospital in time. One of the medicines we give is called TPA. It's a clot-busting medication, but we can only give it within 3 hours of the onset of symptoms. So again, it's so important to get to the emergency room as soon as possible.
Dr. Marie Pazinski is the author of Beautiful Brain, Beautiful You, and you have a website, and now the address is escaping me. Can you tell it to our listeners, please?
Yes, it's www.mariepazinski.com.
Very good. Marie Pazinski is a Harvard neurologist. I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm very honored to welcome into our studios for the very first time Dr. David Timmerman. Dr. Timmerman is the new academic provost at Carthage College. As a matter of fact, he's been on the job for scarcely a month, but he has still kindly agreed to come on The Morning Show at this early point in his tenure at Carthage.
to talk about his own distinguished career in higher education and his impressions of Carthage and his hopes and dreams for the future. We'll also talk about some of the very, very interesting challenges that a school like Carthage is facing in this